The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Hello and welcome to SportFox. Here are your headlines today. Chinese President Xi Jinping meets with the heads of Blackstone, FedEx and Qualcomm in Beijing as the country steps up efforts to woo American investment at the Boa Forum. But China also hits the US with dispute proceedings at the WTO, claiming discriminatory subsidies are hurting its EV sector. That's despite BYD overtaking Tesla on global sales.
The Japanese yen sinking to a 34-year low against the dollar, while the country's finance minister warns the government could take decisive steps. The same words, of course, that he uttered back in 2022 before intervening in the market to stem the yen slide. Search and rescue efforts switched to recovery mode after a catastrophic bridge collapse in Baltimore, with President Biden pledging whatever it takes to rebuild and reopen the port.
I directed my team move heaven and earth to reopen the port and rebuild the bridge as soon as humanly possible. And we're going to work hand in hand with the support of Maryland to support Maryland, whatever they ask for.
Shares of Trump Media surge as much as 50% on the first day of trade, potentially providing the embattled former president with a cash windfall as election season heats up.
Welcome to the show. And let's get into the China story as Chinese President Xi Jinping has met with executives from firms including Blackstone, FedEx and Qualcomm. The meeting comes after Premier Li Qiang chose not to meet with visiting CEOs at the China Development Forum earlier this week. Government officials and top executives are meeting in China at the annual Boa Forum, and Lin Lin is there for us with more. Lin, it does feel as though we're getting very mixed messages out of China. One moment rolling out the red carpet, trying to attract more FDI. The next minute fighting fire with fire when it comes to some of the trade tariffs and sanctions against Chinese companies, namely around technology, EVs and also software.
Yeah, good morning to you, Karen. I think that really exemplifies the state of US-China relations. As you were speaking about just then, 2,600 kilometers from here in Boao, in Beijing, that anticipated expected meeting between President Xi and those top US executives, that did happen. But the question is it really going to move the needle? Because certainly, I was, for example, speaking with the head of the Australia-China Business Council, David Olson, earlier today. He was talking from the Australian perspective that certainly many businesses, while they welcome these very clear, concerted signals coming out from Beijing that China is very much open for business, that they are a lot more cautious and circumspect about their next move, that they will wait to perhaps see when these tangible promises in relation to more market access actually comes through before diving in. And as you mentioned there, you know, this flare-up in terms of tensions between the two sides, that we saw that with TikTok, and then of course yesterday this announcement that China has launched this WTO complaint in relation to the US Inflation Reduction Act. They say that it's discriminatory, that it distorts supply chains because it incentivizes US businesses to keep their EV supply chains in the United States through those subsidies. Now, of course, when we look in the longer term, the remarkable China growth story marked, of course, by its admission into the WTO in December 2001, FDI, foreign direct investment, really crucial part of that story in terms of bringing jobs, bringing the inflows into capital and exports. But we've really seen that slow down in recent times. It was at 30-year lows last year. And then in terms of the most recent data in January and February, it's fallen close to 20%. So that is, I think, the conundrum. And I think it still remains to be seen what will come from all of this? Now, I spoke earlier to the former Commerce Secretary of the US, Carlos Gutierrez. He said that countries are increasingly looking inward rather than outward. He called it political nationalism, and he said that the US is not exempt from that. He said that the Inflation Reduction Act was an example of that. Let's take a listen to what else he had to say.
Well, businesses are trying to navigate what the U.S. government is regulating and what China perceives. And I think they're doing a good job of getting through it, but it's unnecessary obstacles. Businesses should be allowed to decide where they can do business. And the market will tell them whether they should be there or not. Not the U.S. governments, not the governments. That has not been our model. And our model of free enterprise has worked. But today we are seeing a lot more intervention than we have in many years.
Also making headlines today is the Chinese PBOC governor, Peng Gongshan. He's actually at the Boao Forum. He spoke at a open panel discussion about financial cooperation. He said that he wants to see and promote more currency swaps to maintain financial stability. And guys, in about 40 minutes' time, I will also be speaking with Michele Garacci, who is the former Undersecretary of State for the Italian Economic Development Ministry, and we'll be talking about the Belt and Road Project, China's economy, as well as EU-China relations.
Lynn, quick question for you, because you were talking about supply chains, and as we know, a lot of foreign companies have been de-risking their supply chains away from China because of perceived either economic coercion or maybe even unequal access. But, you know, earlier on this week at the China Development Forum, China was saying that they want to ensure that there is equal access for foreign firms, the same access as domestic peers, in order to encourage this foreign investment into China. But my question to you is, how are they going to be able to guarantee that equal access as per WTO rules?
Yeah, and certainly I think that is where the concern comes in terms of the foreign business community that, in the last few days, there has been all of these promises coming through, like what you said, opening up that market access. They've also spoken about allowing for more government tendering, also opening up more lines of communication with government officials. But there is a sense that there is a bit of promise fatigue among some in the business community because, you know, a lot of these promises we've been hearing about since when China opened up from the COVID restrictions early last year. And so, you know, they want to see the details, and really the devil is in the details. We spoke with economist Stephen Roach a couple of days ago, and he says that is certainly the sentiment among many businesses in America, that they want to actually see the tangible, concrete measures. What will it look like? The other concern is in relation to data transfers, because there are concerns about just kind of the amount of requirements on that front. And again, China has said that it will relax those rules as well. But again, they want to see the details. Guys.
Promise fatigue is a good way of putting it. Thank you so much, Lynn, and we'll catch you later on as well. Thank you. Well, we've got some good news, actually. China's industrial profits hitting a two-year high in the first 2 months of the year, growing 10.2% on an annualized basis. The positive data follows better than expected news on factory output, retail sales, and exports. So it does look as if maybe we're getting some green shoots coming through from the Chinese economy. Elsewhere, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte will meet the Chinese President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Qiang later on today in a conversation expected to be dominated by tensions over the country's chip export policy. The Dutch government began denying licenses for exports of ASML's chip manufacturing machines earlier this year, and it is unclear whether the firm will be allowed to service equipment it has already sold to Chinese firms when existing licenses expire.
Let's have a broader conversation about investing in China. Our next guest says there are opportunities for investment there, describing the country's tech names as some of the cheapest global AI tech plays. Emmanuel Hauptmann is with us, founding partner and head of systematic equities at RAM active investments. Emmanuel, thank you for joining us again today. I know some of the major banks and investment managers were saying that China was uninvestable over the last 12 months plus. We have seen some momentum back in the Chinese stock market in recent weeks. And if you look at what's been said from the US, there was a negotiation between top officials with the Chinese saying, look, a lot of American companies feel as though China's been uninvestable in recent years because of raids on certain premises, of exorbitant fines that have been lobbed, different trade decisions that are being made. Why is now the time to get back into Chinese names in your view?
Good morning. So we do think that it's the right time to look back at China selectively. Interestingly, in the last 2 years, when everyone was trying to play the recovery post-COVID, our strategies and our EM strategy were actually strongly underweight China for the last 2.5 years. We've seen a very strong increase of Chinese allocation in the last quarter of last year on the back of much more attractive valuations and some of the largest tech names in China becoming really compelling from this value perspective.
The AI story is an interesting one from the China perspective because firewalls that exist in the West that trap data and stop AI from tapping various different sources isn't necessarily a problem in China. But that said, access to chips to train AI, the most advanced chips, is a problem. So how do we think about China navigating some of those cross currents?
So China is very well positioned on the AI side. It's very much leading with the US currently. They have fantastic research labs and teams. They have a massive amount of data. Should not forget, you know, the size of the country and the data they can rely on. And if you look at recent months, what is very interesting is to see the large tech firms more and more involved on the AI community side. The open source, so Alibaba Cloud open sourced one of the state-of-the-art models on the tech side last year. It's among the models that stand at the very top of the leaderboard by of large language models today. Tencent released models also on their side that they use on their WeChat platform. So the big tech firms are very present. They have models of the highest quality, which basically are, you know, head-to-head with the US. And I think it's a very interesting play, you know, when you look at these Chinese tech firms.
We were just talking a moment ago, Emmanuel, about the paradox that is China wanting to increase its industrial self-reliance, but at the same time also pledging to give foreign companies equal treatment as domestic peers, in other words, trying to encourage more foreign investment. Are there any opportunities to invest on the back of that theme, if indeed we do take China's pledge at face value?
So, and obviously the issue is that China needs inflows, so needs capital flows, and is promising a lot on in terms of foreign investments. You know, I think it's very, it's, you know, remains very risky to build a company in China, to invest in China for corporates. I think it's, you know, from our perspective, from investor perspective, we do believe that and if you avoid the financial sector, the banks, which are more and more exposed to the real estate downside, downturn, that there are very attractive peaks there in the on the tech in the tech front, some of the large tech firms. You know, we just believe that the outflows of the last 2 years have created massive opportunities for stock pickers. It's opportunities that are difficult to assess. I mean, to access if you go through passive investments in the country. So you should be very much selective in picking names there. And that's why we see the, you know, the allocation in our strategies increase significantly in the last few months.
When will property become a screaming buy? I mean, it's just lurched from crisis to crisis and there's no real light at the end of the tunnel as we see it today. But when will it get to the stage where it would be a really good investing opportunity when it's hit bottom?
So the real issue there is that it's a structural issue in China. They have overinvested for more than 20 years in the sector, so in the real estate sector. I think it's going to take a very long time for this unwind that is currently occurring to unfold. I think that banks, it's interesting because the PBOC announced in January a 50 bps cut in the reserve requirement ratio for banks, which freed in some way 1 trillion yuan of liquidity in the Chinese bank system. And they're asking now, if you look at the news released in the last few days, they're asking banks to basically finance 1.5 trillion yuan of loans to the real estate sector with a whitelist by local governments. So it's a somewhat a give and take, you know, from the government on the bank side. They're trying to get banks to lend more to real estate. I do think that the 20 years of overinvestment in the sector are going to lead to a long restructuring of the sector. We've seen how difficult the Evergrande restructuring was last year.
Right.
So, Emmanuel, so I think it's a very long... Yeah.
Can I ask you, though, about some of the comments from the housing minister recently that effectively was going to cast some property adrift, that companies that must go bust should go bust? Does that not touch the sides when it comes to property? Because it seemed like much tougher action than we've seen from the Chinese in recent years.
So I don't think we can expect to see you know, reversal anytime soon. So I think this 1.5 trillion yuan financing by banks of the sector should help basically smooth the restructuring, but it's probably going to last to be long before real estate names, real estate developers become investable again in the country. And we have practically no exposure in our strategies on the sector.
Emmanuel, thank you very much for joining us to talk us through your China cause. Emmanuel Hauptmann with us, founding partner and head of systematic equities at RAM Active Investments. I'll take you to the Japanese yen. It has hit levels not seen since 1990 this morning amid waning expectations of further rate hikes from the BOJ. Below where it slid to in October 2022, when authorities stepped in to stem its slide, Japan's finance minister said the government could take decisive steps. That was the same phrasing used 17 months ago when it intervened. Meanwhile, Bank of Japan Governor Kazuo Ueda has said the central bank is keeping a close eye on FX moves, adding that it's important to support the economy with accommodative monetary conditions for the time being. So we're watching to see that 152 handle and whether there's any breaching of that. Arabile.
Well, Karen, here's what's coming up on the show, right? BYD earnings hitting an all-time high as the EV price war continues. We'll bring you those details. That's coming up a little bit later. Plus, a good day for the Donald as Trump media shares surge on debut. I'll dig into what it means then for the former president. And we'll speak to S4 Capital Chairman, that's Martin Sorrell, as the firm reports full year earnings. Don't miss that exclusive interview at 8:15 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
A slightly weaker day playing out on US markets. And if you look at some of the big names, you can see very much in the news flow, Nvidia, the AI name dominating the market psychology of late. It was the one that was moving down for the Dow, for the likes of the S&P and for the NASDAQ, the stock that had the most impact to the downside. For the Dow, it was Boeing. And of course, Boeing's fortunes well and truly broadcast in recent days and with the imminent departure of Dave Calhoun later this year. So the market's reacting around those stocks, but also a bit of nerves in a shortened trading week as we head towards the end of the week where Jay Powell will be speaking. Markets, don't forget, will be closed with Good Friday and some of the Easter celebrations. But the PCE, the preferred inflation gauge, too, coming out. The market's closely watching that to see whether there's any movement, again, lower in a disinflationary process or whether it's going to prove, again, that there's sticky inflation for the Fed to contend with. So the markets, as you can see, are down four-tenths on the NASDAQ and about a third coming off the S&P 500. But one stock pushing against the grain, chain has been Reddit, and some calling it a meme stock itself, despite the platform really presiding over those meme names. It too now could be joining the ranks of meme stocks. The stock is up 30% odd since its IPO late last week, and you can see in session also bouncing, the stock certainly taking on a life of its own. What we're seeing elsewhere on the Asian markets that are picking up on some of the red from Wall Street, big focus on China and investing in China thanks to the Boa Forum. China stocks, Hong Kong also trading weaker, but bookend by gains we're seeing on the Australian market, weakness in that Japanese yen propelling the Japanese stock market forward, and we're getting closer to some of the highs that we've seen recently above 41,000 points, inching back towards that territory, 9/10 bounce today. US futures, early calls today, we are setting up for some green, so the market looking slightly more positive at this early hour. The S&P 500 closed 3 points above what Goldman's analysts have set as its year-end price target. Chief equity strategist David Costin ran CNBC through some of the numbers.
This market's flat from here to the end of the year, 5,200. That's target. It's expectation that you have modest growth in earnings, around 8% looking into this year and 5% into or 6% into calendar 2025. That's the trajectory of profits. Economists are looking for basically three cuts. One in June, one in September, one in December. And that would be consistent, again, with our forecast around 5,200. All of this information is priced into the market today, which is a good thing.
But former Morgan Stanley CEO James Gorman disagrees on the timing of the Fed's first rate cut.
I would be surprised if they move in the first half of this year. I would not be totally shocked if they don't do anything for the rest of the year. I know the market's pricing now three rate increases versus six a couple of months ago. You know, the Fed has to ask, what's the benefit? And at the moment, the economy remains robust, as you're seeing. The S&P's what, over 5,200. The jobs numbers are great. So that's the only economic thing. I'm not going to forecast doom and gloom for America. The people who've done that have generally been unsuccessful, in my experience.
And away from the economy, the U.S. Coast Guard says six missing construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore when it collapsed are presumed dead. What had been a search and rescue effort has now transitioned into a recovery mission after a fully loaded container ship crashed into one of the bridge's support columns in the early hours of Tuesday morning. President Biden said his administration would cover the cost of rebuilding.
I've directed my team to move heaven and earth to reopen the port and rebuild the bridge as soon as humanly possible. And we're going to work hand in hand with the support of Maryland to support Maryland and whatever they ask for. We're going to work with our partners in Congress to make sure the state gets the support it needs. It's my intention that federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing that bridge. And I expect the Congress to support my effort. This is going to take some time. The people of Baltimore can count on us, though, to stick with them at every step of the way.
NBC News' Jay Gray filed this report.
Just minutes after pulling away from the port, there were signs of trouble. Flickering lights, dark smoke pouring from the stack of the 95,000 gross ton container ship. The pilot issuing a mayday call, warning he'd lost power and propulsion. Just ahead of the vessel, slamming into a center support column on the Francis Scott Key Bridge, the iconic structure crumbling from the force of the impact.
We advise the entire bridge, the entire key bridge in the harbor.
A crew doing routine maintenance, filling potholes, was on the bridge as it collapsed. Two of the workers quickly pulled to safety. But after a full day of teams on, above, and below the water, frantically working to rescue at least six still missing, tonight they acknowledge their mission is shifting to recovery.
That at this point, we do not believe that we're going to find any of these individuals still alive.
24 NTSB investigators are on site now to work through the remnants of the bridge, interview crew members and witnesses, examine the ship and analyze data recorders, trying to piece together how and why the tragedy happened.
The NTSB focuses on the facts, so we will figure that out and be able to provide that information in the coming days. Today is far too early for that.
The beginning of what will be a long and difficult process in the wake of the tragedy. Jay Gray, NBC News, Baltimore.
JP Yong joins us now with more from Singapore. JP, there are still a lot of questions that have been raised that really do need answers.
Indeed, Mandy, and especially because this boat is actually flagged and owned by a Singapore company called Grace Ocean and managed also by a Singaporean company called Synergy Maritime. Now, in a statement, Synergy Maritime did mention that all 22 crew members on the boat are safe and accounted for, and that they are fully cooperating with authorities in the United States with regards to investigations of how the MV Dolly, which is under their management, crashed into that pillar that caused the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. We also heard from the Maritime and Ports Authority here in Singapore, and also in response to claims that there was a loss of propulsion that resulted in that crash. They were quick to clarify that the MV Dolly, in an inspection, has passed all foreign port inspections for its seaworthiness and safety and quality. It also pointed out that in June, they did spot that there was identified at least a failure with regards to a fuel monitor gauge that was rectified before it was able to leave the port of Chile during that inspection. Now, they did also mention that they have sent inspectors over to Baltimore, and they are en route at the moment to also assist U.S. investigation to get to the bottom of the matter and to find out how exactly this big, huge container vessel actually collided with one of the key pillars of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. But as you mentioned, still a lot of questions as to how this happened, whether it was down to human error or whether or not there were issues or lapses, at least with regards to the safety or seaworthiness checks that cleared the MV Dolly from sailing from there. Keep in mind that this container vessel was on its way from the port of Baltimore all the way to Colombo, Sri Lanka, but its 21-day voyage has been halted because of this tragedy that caused the huge catastrophic collapse of this key bridge on the eastern seaboard of the United States.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to cnbc.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.